Welcome to Audio Notes. Cellos and fugues are the big topic of discussion on this session. I'm your host, Nikki Sweat, and I'm also a cellist and a big fan of musical counterpoint, which gives me a strong bias toward the theme of the Menlo concert on Sunday, July 24th. All of the music on this program puts the cello on display, from a string quartet by Joseph Haydn that is among the first in the genre to emphasize the instrument as a soloistic voice, to extra cello string quintets by Luigi Boccherini and Alexander Glazunov, to music for four cellos by Alexander Tansman and Michael Finkel that explores the very limits of what the instrument can do. The enormous range of the cello makes it a crucial actor in constructing instrumental fugues, a composition strategy where different players take on the role of different voices, presenting developments of the same subject in conversation with one another. We'll start by talking about the cello. One of the crucial innovations that we can credit to Joseph Haydn was introducing soloistic material for the cello into formal string quartet writing. In his groundbreaking Opus 20 Quartets of 1772, it's not that he de-emphasized the first violin, but he began to balance out the role of the instruments. In particular, he took advantage of the singing tenor range of the cello, and the possibility of the viola providing a bass line underneath melodies sung out in that range. The best example of this comes at the very beginning of the first movement of the first piece on this program, Haydn's Quartet in C Major, Opus 20, Number 2. The cello sings the moderato melody, the second violin supports the tune with thirds underneath, and the viola provides an arpeggiated, contrasting bass line. Then we get the usual first violin solo. But crucially, Haydn puts the violin's version of this tune up a fifth. The entrance of the first solo was in C major. And the violin's answer to that solo was an exact repetition of the cello's tune, but in G major. This is the basic principle of fugue. A melodic subject is introduced, then another voice enters with a responding repetition of that subject, but in a different tonality. Then, the other voices of the group proceed to enter in a similar fashion, while the voices that entered first dance and chatter around the new presentations of that melodic line. In this quartet, when, after a pause, the second violin comes in with the opening figure back in C major, it seems like Haydn is continuing this fugue-like structure, but instead, he wanders off into bridging material. He leads us to a lyrical contrasting theme, and a stormy cello-heavy development section. Recapitulation of all of the themes. So this movement isn't really a fugue. For that, we'll have to wait for the final movement. But Haydn does emphasize from the first here that the practice of imitation between the instruments of the quartet is crucial to following the thread of the piece, and he suggests that the role of the cello is pretty important to that imitation process. The dramatic unison C minor opening of the second movement hints at the Baroque French overtures that would precede fugues at the start of dance suites. Again, Haydn draws a connection between this contrapuntal writing and cello solos. We hear that opening repeated, but the cello plays the tune below sustained lines in the other instruments. The almost shouted intensity of the unisons that periodically crop up make this music sound kind of like recitatives from Baroque operas. Given this austere quality throughout the movement, it's a total shock when, in the middle, we hear this violin aria, which almost sounds like something Giuseppe Verdi would have written 100 years later. This is music of extraordinary contrast, contrast that's mostly made possible by opening up the potential of every member of the string quartet. This strange movement ends on an unresolved sonority, and so it does serve as a kind of prelude, as its Baroque ancestors would, but rather than heading into a fugue, which would heighten the tension with more and more counterpoint, it takes us into this pastoral minuet movement, where hurdy-gurdy drones support a tender lullaby-like tune. Now, expected cello solo comes in the trio, in C minor, featuring outbursts in unison as in the second movement, and a melodic line that's very close to that tune we heard at the beginning of the Adagio. The middle movements of this piece have established a tension between a quartet in unison, a quartet accompanying one melody, and a quartet of four musicians set truly against one another in independent voices that create these complex contrapuntal textures. To work through this conflict, Haydn closes on a true fugue, but it's quite a complicated one. The first violin enters alone with a subject, as a fugue ought to start. They play an octave, a chromatic descent, some figurations. The second violin plays that subject up a fourth a few bars later. But it's a bit hard to hear, because the viola has prematurely introduced this counter melody. Haydn indicates in the score, and we discover while listening, that that counter melody is in fact just another fugal subject, one of a total of four subjects that the musicians will all be discussing over the course of this pretty short movement. Once the cello enters, the texture becomes complex, and determining which musical motif the discourse is focused on at any given time becomes difficult. I view this finale as something of a choose-your-own-adventure experience. You could follow what a single instrument does, or try to track one of the subjects as it gets passed between them, or just enjoy the chattering waves of sound that Haydn creates. This degree of contrapuntal chaos makes the ending of the piece all the more effective, where suddenly the fugal writing gives way to an operatic drive to the finish. We close the piece on a unison presentation of the first subject we heard, but turned upside down, a move that suggests a striking argument that Haydn's making here against strict counterpoint in favor of a varied mix of musical styles and instrumental identities. Here's where I'll note that Haydn was not the only one to be exploring alternative instrumental potentials at this time. In the 1770s, the cellist and composer Luigi Boccherini had taken up a post in Spain, and at this time he wrote numerous works for string quartet and an extra cello, to be performed by himself and a quartet that he worked with at his court. The quintet in E major displays how Boccherini's cello bias leads him to write a distribution of parts that's even more democratic than that of Haydn. He in fact seems to skew against the first violin a little bit, so I thought it would be worthwhile to get the perspective of a violinist on all this cello music. Jennifer Frouchy told me more about Boccherini's quite unique compositional tactics in his 1771 E major string quintet.
The first movement of the Boccherini quintet is labeled amoroso, which is this lovely term which, you know, means loving, tender. The tempo marking is andantino mosso, but it's also marked consordino. So it's amoroso and muted. So that points to this very tender, kind of caressing type of music. It's interesting because there's a B section to this movement, a kind of second section, which is, you know, declamatory. And then when we come back to the opening section, so it's basically an ABA form, we come back to that opening lovely melody. And then after the first eight bars, the two celli suddenly have this very high, rapid, fluttering 32nd note exchange. And it's really, like, to me, like, you know, a heart fluttering, like, not out of fear, but out of, you know, this excitement of being in love. In the second movement of the Boccherini, it opens in a somewhat expected manner, which is to say, you know, the violins take the lead. And again, not a super high register, but sort of more in the upper register. But then, again, somewhat unexpectedly, the celli take over the solo line in the upper register. They're in a like a high voice. Second half of the second movement, the second violin, actually, who usually plays lower traditionally than the first violin and usually often takes a kind of more subsidiary role or a supporting role, the second violin starts out in a higher register than the first, which is also surprising and doesn't happen that often. As the second half of the second movement moves along, the second violin actually plays this virtuosic passage that the first violin had in the beginning of the movement. It takes over and plays actually the first violin part in that higher register. So that's also interesting and playful on Boccherini's part, you know, I think quite unconventional. Anyone who's gone through any kind of Suzuki training knows this minuet very well, and it's, you know, I think it's used outside of Suzuki as well as a, you know, kind of a training piece. What makes it more interesting is the first bar, da 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 dum bum 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 ba da. It follows a kind of unexpected rhythmic pattern too, right? It's not da 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 dum bum ba dum ba. That would be boring, and that would probably, if you'd done that, it would probably be less popular. In the menuet, Boccherini orchestrates or voices it in a really interesting way. The violin in the main body of the minuet carries this lovely tune, and underneath there's this interesting texture where the second violin has this bubbling 16th note figuration, mostly just octaves, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it creates this kind of interesting texture. And then underneath that, the viola and the first cello have a fun 8th note pizzicato pattern, bum 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 bum. And then the bass line, which is this, the second cello, is just playing on the beat, bum, 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 but kind of more like a, you know, what we consider now to be a jazz line. What's also interesting is in the trio of the minuet, the line gets broken up. Again, you know, we've been talking about how Boccherini passes melodic material around the entire quintet. I think that's much more interesting, that conversational aspect. It's like a really great dinner party, you know, where there's five people who are conversing back and forth, but they're not stepping on each other's toes. And it's, again, natural how they're conversing. The last movement of the Boccherini, it's a rondo, and the rondo material is essentially led by the violins. And so it's the writing there is pretty straightforward in terms of what our expectations might be. There are three different episodes which come between each of the statements of the rondo. And because, again, Boccherini is so endlessly inventive, each of the episodes features different instrument combinations. In the first episode, the second violin and first cello kick it off, but then cede pretty immediately to the viola. In the second episode, again here the second violin starts. The first violin is ceding control. And then actually that leads, this second episode is really, to me, the second and third are both quite amazing, but it leads to this really remarkable section. There's a G major section, the two celli just hold a long G pedal. They're just holding G. And now again, the second violin, not the first violin, but the second violin has this really fun arpeggiated solo. Finally, you know, in the third episode is where finally the first violin gets to shine with very virtuosic writing, rapid triplet figures, and again, trilling and turns and leaps of octaves and then broken chords, which, you know, this rapid 30-second figuration, reminiscent of the virtuosic writing that the second violin had in the second episode. You know, what to me is most interesting as a violinist and, you know, as a narcissistic first violinist type. In these three episodes, it's really only until the third episode that the first violin actually takes over. You know, it ends with the first violin getting a star turn, but, you know, the viola, the second violin, first cello, second cello, all get to be featured.
For the second half of the concert program, the cello forces double once again, with two works for cello quartet. First, two movements for four cellos, written in 1935 by the Polish composer Alexander Tansman. Cellist Inbal Segev, who recently wrote a cello quartet of her own, talked about some of the joys and challenges of this instrumentation, and she told me more about Tansman's compositional style.
The difficult thing about writing for a cello quartet is obviously we're all playing cello, so it's hard to differentiate both voices, and it can sound muddy. Here, he really separates the first cello as sort of the violin in a quartet, and in the first movement, you have sort of the second cello, maybe you can call it a viola, you know, an alto, it changes, but certainly the first cello is soaring above. In the second movement, the fast movement, it's more egalitarian. I feel like even though the first cello still has a lot of higher passages, the group is homogenized. In the second movement, he uses different techniques. So there's a spiccato in that kind of perpetuo mobile in the bottom cello to start. Then all cellos are coming together. Later he uses pizzicatos. He uses harmonics at one point, and obviously the spread of range. So the first cello is really playing high. It's a difficult part. And the second cello joins them on occasion as well. You know, we have 5 octaves to our instrument, 5 playable, very playable, maybe 6 octaves that we can really use. And that's a big range. So he uses that. I really loved reading about his background because he was Jewish. He even did a tour of Israel at some point in his life. He immigrated to the U.S. just before Second World War to escape the Nazis. And then he came back to his adopted country, France. So he lived in Paris. But he is Polish. He is a Polish composer, and he always says that he's first and foremost Polish. And so I was listening to the music and trying to see, oh, does it sound Jewish? It did not sound Jewish to me. And then, but I certainly, you know, you can find, if you look hard enough, you can find anything. So there is some F minor, harmonic minor that could be Jewish sounding or Middle Eastern sounding, say in the second movement around rehearsal 7. And then, you know, Ravel was his mentor. He actually not only met with him, I think he really worked with him. I don't know exactly, but he had a big influence on him. And you can really hear the Ravel quartet actually in bar 5 of the first movement, in my opinion. And it's beautiful. So very French at some points. And then later I hear jazz, those accents. He also was influenced by Baroque forms. And so you can hear, for example, in the last movement, a fugue. He said himself that, you know, the past is very important. Tradition is like a tree, he said. Dry branches fall down, but uprooting the tree is dangerous. the roots must remain.
The narrator says it all in the next piece on this program, a 1964 setting of an E.B. White poem by the American composer Michael Finkel.
Sir Hansen's cow is dead! His red cow, bitten on the udder by an adder.
Like the poem, this piece is titled The Red Cow is Dead. Michael Finkel wrote it for the Finkel Family Cello Quartet, which included himself, his brother Chris, his father George, and his cousin, David Finkel, co-artistic director of music at Menlo. David told me what the cellos do in this piece to create the sounds of the world that the poet describes.
In The Red Cow is Dead, the first sounds we hear from the cellos anticipate the opening line of the poem. The combination of accented harmonics and plucked notes produces a mellow, ringing tone, tolling the bells for a sad occasion.
Toll the bell, fellow. This is a sad day at Wello.
For much of the piece, the cellos exchange sliding utterances, or perhaps utterances, melancholy moos from Sir Hansen's herd.
Sir Hansen's cow is dead! His red cow, bitten on the udder by an adder.
This prized cow was bitten on the udder by an adder, whose hissing can be heard in a mix of leaping pizzicatos, ricochet effects, and glassy ponticello sounds.
The grass was lush at very last, and the snake, a low sneak, passed, hissed.
We mix and match these noises, assisting the narration until the counterpoint of colorful sound gives way to a unison climax. The narrator laments that the cow's bellow shall never be heard again, and the cellos respond together with a violent chorus of moos.
Sir Hansen's cow, never again to freshen, never again bellow with passion. A ruminant in death's covenant.
The concert closes with another work for two cellos, viola, and two violins. Alexander Glazunov wrote his quintet in A major in 1892. After a long period of dormancy for this extra cello quintet instrumentation, the piece is full of long romantic melodies, like the viola tune that starts it off. But to develop these long tunes, Glazunov relies on the imitative counterpoint that's so present in other works on the program. Later on in the movement, a short triplet gesture from that opening theme gets passed around. We think it might build to something quite complex, but the discussion quickly fades back into a melody with accompaniment texture and a sweet and smooth line in the viola. The moments of canon or of imitative counterpoint are like that in this movement. They're never long, and they're very carefully placed to give us this sense that the themes have some place they could go in conversation with one another, but that they haven't gone yet. I think that underlying sense that these themes have a potential that hasn't been realized is one of the reasons it's so exhilarating when at the very end of the movement, that little triplet motif takes on this bounding, carefree, celebratory character. In the second movement, Glazunov makes use of harmonics and pizzicatos and how the instruments of the quintet sound different when using those techniques to create this appealing scene. The atmosphere is just a bit like Finkel's Farmscape, but it's a whole lot more melodious. Contrasting down-tempo trio sections of this movement involve a contrapuntal buildup from the upper strings, where each entry adds a layer of vocal density above the strumming cellos. The violins and the viola become narrators here, telling some dark tale of the past and interrupting one another with their varied renditions. Glazunov makes good on his promise that this is a cello quintet in the third movement. It opens with these dramatic cello sighs, and when the tragic main theme is played in the cello, we see how well it suits that instrument's tenor range. The second cello is also very important in this movement, starting and ending key modulation sequences with soloistic bass lines. Is mostly preoccupied with this deep nostalgia that we find in that first tune, but the clouds also part at the end with this special ethereal back and forth between the first violin and the first cello. The refrain in the final movement can only be described as swashbuckling. In this allegro, Glazunov gives us the last glimpses of fugue that we'll hear on this concert. They take the form of these transitional fugatos, or mini-fugues, that occur after a clearing of the group's texture. That distinctive practice of one-by-one entry and imitation gives Glazunov a chance to develop important motifs, as he does in this episode that leads back to the movement's swashbuckling refrain. ¶¶ fugue subject winds up being the signal that Glazunov is shutting things down at the very end of the piece. It leads to this cacophonous and exciting close for this quintet and for this concert, a great way to celebrate the musical power of cellos and fugues. Audio notes are written and produced by myself, Nikki Sweat, in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Jennifer Frauchi, Inbal Segev, and David Finkel for speaking with me on this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Haydn's String Quartet in C Major, Opus 20, No. 2, was played by the Orion String Quartet. Boccherini's Quintet for two violins, viola, and two cellos in E major, Opus 13, No. 5, was played by Jamie Laredo, Pinkus Zuckerman, Walter Trampler, Leslie Parnas, and Lynn Harrell. Alexander Tansman's two movements for four cellos was performed by David Finkel, Carter Bray, Jerry Grossman, and Dorothea Figueroa. Michael Finkel's The Red Cow is Dead for four cellos and narrator was performed by Fred Child, Jerry Grossman, Richard Aaron, Raphael Figueroa, and James Jonghwan Kim. And Glazunov's String Quintet in A Major, Opus 39, was played by Sean Lee, Alexi Kenny, Yura Lee, Nicholas Kanalakis, and David Finkel. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.